All right, welcome back to the deep dive. You ever get that feeling when you're researching a case, like you're wading through a ton of information, but you're really looking for that one key insight?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in a field like law, where the details can be so dense and, well, frankly, sometimes pretty dry.
Exactly. Like you just want to cut to the chase and have that aha moment where it all clicks.
Right, that moment where you see how the law actually plays out in the real world. And that's what we're aiming for today as we take a deep dive into Girton v. Michigan, a case that's deeply intertwined with the Flint water crisis.
So, as many of our listeners probably know, the Flint water crisis started back in 2014 when the city switched its water source to the Flint River, supposedly a cost-saving measure.
Right, but the huge problem was that the water from the river wasn't treated properly.
Yeah, and that led to lead leaching from aging pipes into the drinking water, which obviously had serious health implications for the residents. And despite mounting evidence of this contamination, officials were telling people the water was safe.
And this, of course, sparked a lot of outrage and eventually led to legal action. Sherry Girton and other residents of Flint filed a lawsuit under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983, alleging that their 14th Amendment right to bodily integrity had been violated.
Okay, so right there, we've got some really heavy constitutional issues coming into play.
We absolutely do. This case really forces us to examine the boundaries of governmental power and how we protect individual rights, especially when it comes to something as fundamental as public health.
So let's get into the heart of the legal battle here. We're looking at two crucial questions, right? First, did the actions of the officials involved in this whole water situation actually shock the conscience enough to be considered a violation of substantive due process?
Yeah, and that's a really high bar to clear. The shocks the conscience standard comes from the Supreme Court's decision in Rochin v. California, a case where police officers forcibly pumped a suspect's stomach to get evidence. The court found that to be so outrageous, so fundamentally unfair, that it violated the Due Process Clause.
So you're saying for something to shock the conscience, it has to be extremely egregious.
Extremely. And in Girton, the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals had to decide if exposing a whole community to lead-contaminated water could possibly meet that standard.
Wow. And the second big question, the one that always seems to pop up in these cases, qualified immunity. Are these officials protected from liability?
That's right. Qualified immunity is designed to shield government officials from being sued for their actions unless they violated clearly established law, and a reasonable person in their position should have known better. It's meant to allow officials to make decisions without fearing lawsuits at every turn.
But even at this early stage of the Girton case, in response to a motion to dismiss, the Sixth Circuit's approach to qualified immunity was a bit unusual.
It was. Normally, courts try to settle the qualified immunity issue pretty early on. But here, the Sixth Circuit said, "Hold on, we need more facts." They felt like the allegations against the officials were serious enough that if they were true, qualified immunity might not apply.
So they needed more info before deciding if the officials' actions were so bad they couldn't be shielded.
Exactly. Now, even within the Sixth Circuit, there was some disagreement about this. The majority opinion basically said, "Look, the residents are claiming more than just negligence or bad judgment. They're alleging intentional misconduct, or at least a deliberate indifference to the risks."
So they weren't just careless, they knowingly ignored the problem.
That was the allegation. And the majority was particularly focused on the lack of corrosion controls, even though the risks were apparently known. They felt that if this deliberate indifference was proven, it could be enough for a constitutional violation.
But then we have Judge Kethledge, who wrote a pretty strong dissent.
Oh, a very strong dissent. He was basically saying, "Wait a minute. We're muddying the waters between tort law and constitutional law here."
Tort law being more about negligence and stuff like that.
Exactly. Negligence is usually dealt with in state courts, and Judge Kethledge argued that even if the officials were grossly negligent, that alone doesn't automatically equal a constitutional violation. He was worried that letting this case go forward too easily would essentially make federal courts the place to go for any tort claim against the government.
Interesting. So we're seeing this classic tension between accountability and protecting government officials.
Right. On the one hand, you want to hold officials responsible when they mess up, especially when public health is at stake. But on the other hand, you don't want to make them so afraid of lawsuits that they can't do their jobs effectively.
Yeah, I can see both sides of that. Okay, let's break down some of these legal concepts a bit more. Substantive due process, that's a big one. How did the court define the right to bodily integrity in this case, given the whole Flint water situation?
They basically defined it as the right to be free from harm caused by the government, especially when you don't consent to that harm.
So being forced to drink lead-contaminated water when the government knew about it would be a violation of that right.
That was the argument. It goes back to that fundamental idea that we have control over our own bodies.
Now, we talked about shocks to the conscience, but can you tell us more about why that standard is so high? Like, why is it so hard to prove?
Well, think about it. If every government mistake or misstep could be considered a constitutional violation, you'd have lawsuits flying everywhere.
And that would probably paralyze government action, right?
Exactly. So the shocks to the conscience standard is there to ensure that only the most egregious conduct, the stuff that truly goes against our sense of justice and fairness, is considered a violation of the Constitution. It keeps the balance between accountability and letting the government function.
Makes sense. Now, the dissent in Girton was really worried about expanding substantive due process too far. Why was that?
They were concerned that if the court made it too easy to claim a violation of substantive due process, it could essentially turn into a catch-all for any claim against the government, no matter how minor.
So like you said before, it could turn federal courts into giant tort courts.
Right. And that would undermine the whole system of federalism, where certain issues are supposed to be handled at the state level.
Okay, back to qualified immunity for a sec. You mentioned it has two parts, or prongs. What were those again?
The first prong is whether the official's conduct actually violated a constitutional right. And the second is whether that right was clearly established at the time, meaning a reasonable official in that position should have known their actions were wrong. Both prongs have to be met for qualified immunity to be overcome.
Got it. Now, Judge Sutton, who concurred with the majority, raised some interesting points about federalism, too. What was his take?
Judge Sutton agreed that discovery should move forward, but he was concerned about federal courts jumping in before the state courts had a chance to weigh in.
So he thought the federal court might be stepping on the state court's toes.
In a sense, he was worried that a premature ruling by the federal court could interfere with how Michigan handles these issues under its own state laws. It's all about respecting the boundaries between federal and state authority.
But the majority felt it was important to get the ball rolling at the federal level, right?
They did. Given the seriousness of the allegations and the potential long-term health consequences, they wanted to give the residents a chance to gather evidence. They felt it would be irresponsible to dismiss the case outright before understanding the full picture.
And Judge Divens, who also concurred, highlighted the importance of discovery, right?
She did. She basically reminded everyone that at this early stage, the court has to accept the plaintiff's allegations as true. Discovery is where you get to test those allegations and see if they hold up. It's a fundamental part of the legal process.
All right, last thing on Judge Kesslidge's dissent. What did he see as the biggest problem with the majority's approach?
He kept coming back to the idea that even gross negligence, even a blatant failure to act responsibly, shouldn't automatically be considered a violation of the Constitution. He really believed that those situations are best addressed under state tort law, not federal constitutional law.
And he also had that concern about defining the right too broadly, right?
Absolutely. He used the example of a right to clean water. If the court recognized such a broad right, it would make it almost impossible to determine whether that right was clearly established, which would make it very hard to ever hold officials accountable under qualified immunity.
But the majority pushed back on that, saying they were focused on the alleged intentional harm, not just some policy failures.
Right. They argued that the plaintiffs had plausibly alleged that officials knew about the lead and intentionally misled the public. That was the key factor for them.
Okay, so ultimately the Supreme Court decided not to review the case.
Right. They denied certiorari, which means the Sixth Circuit's ruling stands. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily mean the Supreme Court agrees with everything the Sixth Circuit said, but they weren't ready to step in at that point.
All right, so for all the law students out there listening, what are the big takeaways from Girton? What should they be thinking about?
Well, first, it shows how tricky it can be to balance accountability with protecting government officials from frivolous lawsuits. Second, it emphasizes how important it is to have a strong argument when you're pleading a constitutional violation, especially at that early motion to dismiss stage. You have to convince the court that there's at least a plausible case. Third, it reminds us that not every instance of government negligence is going to be a constitutional issue. But if you can show deliberate indifference to a serious risk, that might be enough. And finally, it really highlights the importance of understanding qualified immunity and how those two prongs work in practice. It's not always a clear-cut issue.
I think that's a really good summary of the key points. Girton is a fascinating case because it gets at the heart of how we hold government accountable, especially in a crisis like the Flint water situation.
And it raises those fundamental questions about how we interpret and apply constitutional protections when individual rights clash with government actions.
Absolutely. Thanks for walking us through all of this. I think this deep dive is giving our listeners a lot to think about.
I hope so. These are complex issues, but they're incredibly important. It's crucial to keep asking these questions and to keep pushing for accountability when government fails to protect its citizens.
Couldn't agree more. All right, until next time, keep exploring those legal landscapes, everyone.
And keep asking those tough questions. That's how we learn and grow.